Is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Joanna LaForgia from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be presenting content from the May 2025 issue of Southern Living magazine. This week, we're going to continue pick up on the story that we started last week about The Heart of Appalachia. Author Barbara Kingsolver, best-selling author, Southern author, Barbara Kingsolver, writes that story. So we'll pick up on that. We'll also get to a short essay on how to publish your own book, which we briefly previewed in Life at SL. Someone mentioned in an essay we were reading there. And then if we have time, we'll get to Ivy's Kitchen. All right? Ready? Okay, so we're going to just reread. Oh, the cover of this magazine, which we described in the first, the May 2nd podcast. We described more fully there, but it's a huge white two-floor colonial, it looks like. White clapboard on top, white brick on the bottom, white chimney, and it has in the foreground a huge tree, and I should know what this tree is. I can tell you that it is not an oak. I can't even tell you that for sure. All right, but it's a beautiful tree, and it is overhanging the roof of the house, and there are some white hydrangea bushes in the front and two pups on the lawn. And one, they appear to be pedigrees. I don't know which kind because they're not too visible to me, but they're white backgrounds and they have black or brown markings on them. Cute. Okay, so this is Barbara Kingsolver's hurricane story, as it says on the cover of the magazine. And we're going to just reread the first paragraph just that we read last in our last episode just to get us situated, all right? It was only because of family members in Florida that I tracked weather news on Friday, September 27, while making breakfast for a house guest who was headed out soon. We lingered over coffee, laughing as the lights flickered and the wind howled. I tried to believe the pounding rain was good news after our disastrously hot summer. But when the house went dark with a final shutter, our friend took the cue to exit. Without a cell signal to guide her, my husband and I led her to the interstate ourselves. Minutes later, we came back to a home barricaded by fallen trees. We clambered through a sideways walnut to get inside and then peered out branch-darkened windows, quietly watching 15-inch deep buckets on our patio overfill with rain. 20 miles away in Damascus, Virginia, Deanna Wolfe was in her kitchen on the phone with a friend. She recalls, "I looked out the window and said, 'There's water coming in the park. Muddy water just pouring in.' Then she said, 'Grab what you can. We'll be right there.' But the two creeks skirting Damascus had already converged in a swollen torrent, swallowing the main road through town. Deanna opened her door to find an emergency rescue vehicle outside, its hubcaps underwater. She jumped in and directed the driver to nearby houses. One by one, they climbed into the truck bed. The last neighbor is alive today because Deanna insisted the emergency workers pound on the door until she woke up and escaped in her pajamas. They drove out with water coming over the windshield. A few blocks away, just past the broken bridge clotted with trees and overturned vehicles, past the yellow house that left its foundation and split in half, Yancey Wilmoth was directing traffic. Like all of us, she'd had other plans. She and her husband had booked an inn in Blowing Rock, North Carolina, for their second anniversary. but the innkeepers reached her with news of impassable roads and mayhem. Yancey, the chief of police at Emory and Henry University, got a call from the Abingdon Police Department, where she also works part-time. She was urgently needed in Damascus. Cars were trying to cut through town to find people that were lost, but the roads weren't open, she says. The river went straight through churches, houses, businesses. All the sewage lines were broken. There were power poles down, massive sinkholes with cars fallen in them. We were just trying to keep people safe. Over 100 miles south, Kenan Lee Culp was doing the same. Born and raised on a farm in Madison County, North Carolina, he restores vintage travel trailers for a living in the close-knit community of Black Mountain. The storm was intense that morning, he recalls. But I'm used to storms. We're nowhere near the river, much higher than any flood that had happened before. He was surprised to hear from his mother a half mile away that water was rising in her yard. He hopped in his van to go get her, only to confront tangled trees and power lines. I backtracked to the main road, then all the way to the old highway, but it was one massive tree after another, or a bridge out. I passed a place where several families and trailer homes washed away. The road itself was a creek, just rocks and boulders, he said. He finally reached her house on a dirt road. Excuse me, listeners. He finally reached her house on a dirt bike. After helping his mother to safety, he set off to find others in trouble. Power was off. Phones were out. I had no idea how widespread it was, he says. At my house, we were equally in the dark. We harvested supper from our melting freezer, cooked on the wood stove, and wondered if our families had heard our town was hit by a storm. When the rain stopped, we hiked up the mountain behind our home in search of a strong enough cell signal to reassure them. We followed a line of snapped utility poles to the mountaintop, struggling to believe our eyes. Huge oaks and poplars were laid down like dominoes the full length of the ridge. Some of these giants had stood a century or more. The weak signal we found brought stunning news. Hurricane Helene had made meteorological history, wrecking hundreds of miles of North Carolina, Tennessee, and Southwest Virginia. We joined over 3 million powerless households. Power, though, is in the heart of the beholder. If Appalachians know anything, it's how to take care of one another. Within hours of the storm's passing, communities were organizing soup kitchens and cleanup brigades. Neighbors brought chainsaws and borrowed excavators to clear debris and search for survivors, many still isolated behind washed-out roads. Volunteers used everything from ATVs to pack mules to reach them, prioritizing the delivery of drinking water, oxygen, and insulin. And listeners, on almost half of this page, there is a drawing in colors, a drawing of a washed-out road along the river. It's apparently just after the rains had stopped. There are fallen branches across this road, several fallen branches across this road. There's some greenery in the background, but it's a bit dark, and there are some stones throughout the road as well. And in the foreground, we see the back of what appears to be a man riding a dirt bike. And he's got a backpack on and a helmet on and a gray jacket, gray trousers. And there's a red bag of some sort behind him on this dirt bike. And he's in the front of the picture about to ride up this very, what appears to be a long road that curves in the background that's strewn with fallen trees and rocks. Okay, continuing Barbara King Solvers, narrative, exploring on Saturday. Keenan ran into Kurt Rademacher, director of operations for Bounty and Soul, a nonprofit offering food and other resources to people in need. The Presbyterian Church had a gas stove that worked, and Kurt was in there cooking, he says. I thought, great, here's something I can do. And I started cutting vegetables. I was barefoot. My boots had gotten covered in mud. I thought, food safety rules? We'll do our best. In a phoneless new world, volunteers remembered the age-old skill of making a plan and sticking to it. At 10 every morning, they met at Bounty and Soul to distribute food. More locations for getting help cropped up. Everybody brought out grills and food that was thawing from their freezers. At parks, in the middle of neighborhoods, this just happened. People gave us all they had to share, Keenan says. A propane-fueled refrigerated van became the cooler for the town. Local restaurants donated everything in their freezers, filling it up to the top. He woke early each day with his mind rushing. First, I'd head to the food hub. By then, we were supplying 4 kitchens out in the far-flung areas. Then I'd go out on foot and try to find people who hadn't been reached. Trained as an Eagle Scout, he carried supplies, flashlights, and tactical first aid kits. Every day, more volunteers were finding their roles. When we saw people we'd been working with, we gave each other hugs. We'd made it through another day. The next most urgent need was information. Volunteers taped poster boards on a church van with alphabetized columns for names. Keenan explains, if you learned someone was alive, you wrote their name on the list. Yancey spent days worried about relatives living in the hardest-hit zones of North Carolina before she heard from her sister in Fletcher. They had one spot in the neighborhood with cell service, so they all took chairs up there. They called it Signal Hill. People brought meals and shared information to let loved ones know they were alive, she says. Yancey's family was safe, but had harrowing stories of falling trees, flooded businesses, a rescue from a storm-struck workplace. They put their losses aside and got busy coordinating shelters and cooking in church parking lots. Her sister, Tyree Wilmoth, is International Program Senior Manager for Wine to Water, a nonprofit dedicated to improving access to clean water in developing countries. Suddenly, these skills were needed at home. My sister was boots on the ground, going door to door, handing out water purification kits, says Yancey. At our house, our friend Matthew Kelly was the first to climb through fallen branches and knock on the door. Proof of a world still out there where friendship is steadfast, even if nothing else is. An English professor at Emory and Henry, Matthew has fully embraced our community since relocating from Iowa and had spent the previous day volunteering at a food distribution center in Damascus. He found nobody exactly in charge, just helpful people who fell into a rhythm of work. As hours passed, he felt a bond with the men beside him, chatting as they steadily moved goods from trucks to warehouse. At day's end, he was surprised to see one of them get in a truck emblazoned with Confederate flags. Matthew is black. He and I talked about the dissonance between that symbol, which felt so hurtful to someone whose ancestors were enslaved, and the driver with whom he'd shared the experience of selfless service. Rural Appalachia is complicated. I've thought about that so much, he says, the things that separate us and the things that pull us together. Our mission that day was love. Our foreman was care. And listeners, on this page, on the bottom half, is another drawing in color, and it's a We appear to be on a mountainside here. The background are all black clouds and some gray clouds. And there are some green evergreens at the top right, which is the highest part of this mountainside. And then going down the mountainside in the background are sparser deciduous trees drawn. And then closer to the, in the foreground, as we proceed down, is a fallen tree, uprooted deciduous tree, green tree. And in the also in the foreground is a house, a huge yellow two-floor house. It's yellow with black roofing, and there is a porch. There appears to be a porch, or what remains of a porch, just the roof and two posts in the back of the house. The house is sliding. It's tilted, so it is appears to be sliding off its foundation. There is green grass beneath it, but there's broken ground just after that, and a bit of a muddy flood just to the side of the house. And there are long raindrops diagonally falling all across the foreground of this picture. Okay, back to Barbara Kingsolver. In our week without household power, water, or internet, we boiled spring water, cooked over a fire, helped neighbors, and looked after our farm. Our sheep happily ate the uprooted forest that was deposited in their fields. I read a book a day. We're glad no trees hit us directly. But our region aches for missing lives, livelihoods, even whole communities. Keenan sums up the shock. When your life turns upside down, usually the rest of the world is still there. This time, the whole world turned upside down. You can't just merge back into it when you're ready. I collected survival stories. Keenan spoke of camaraderie and trauma and the illness that struck after he worked in a chemical-contaminated flood zone. He needed a place to park his temporary home, an airstream he'd been restoring, so we offered our farm. I tracked down Deanna in provisional accommodations kindly loaned to her by friends. It looked like a metal storage building, but was fully bedecked inside with pictures of her daughters and wall hangings reminding us to be grateful for every day. Deanna says she's trying. We first met years ago at a book signing, where I found out she has exactly the same name as the protagonist of the novel I'd just published. I apologized if the coincidence embarrassed her. My fictional Deanna had quite a love life. The real Deanna grinned, saying I'd made her the most famous librarian in Damascus. She's now retired after 20 years at that job, and my first thought was for her books. She lost them all. The mobile home she bought new 14 years ago was unsalvageable. She'd loved her home, with its yard full of hydrangeas and butterfly bushes. Her neighbors were like family. I expected to live there until I left this earth, she says. It's hard for her to talk about what she found when she went back. Mold up to the ceilings. Her whole life of books and photo albums buried in mud. She rescued some furniture, wall hangings, and the cement garden angels outside her door. She's trying hard to make her nest in this box. I just have moments where she pauses, looking away. I want to go home. And listeners, on the bottom half of this page is a drawing of the sky now is no longer gray in the background. It's blue. It's a dark blue. But it's a dark teal blue with gray mixed in. And in the background are also some green hills, little hillsides, and some green, short green shrubbery. And an overhanging tree, or just the limb and branch of a tree overhanging in the right corner and the left corner. In the foreground, we have the brown, muddy water, a road full. Look, it really looks more like a lake, but there is a truck in it, which is why I'm calling it a road. It's a huge, huge washed out road. Brown, muddy water, coffee-colored brown and light-colored cafe au lait brown around the puddle, which this truck is making. And the truck is a pickup truck. And in the pickup truck are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 people that I can see in the pickup truck. 11 we can see here. And the pickup truck is gray. And these are the people in the back of the truck, of course. We're not counting the driver who we can't see. The windows are dark. And the people, and it is raining. We do have the now diagonal raindrops going in the other direction from the previous page. And there are some logs floating down in the foreground as well. Broken tree limbs, it appears to be. And a sign, a stop sign and a no left turn sign beneath it. And that is tilted in the foreground on the left. It looks like it's about to tip over. And the people in the flatbed truck are all different hues, different colors, different shades of brown, black, and white. Mostly brown, different shades of brown and white. And there is one, and one black. And there it seems to be an even distribution of men and women. Mostly gray shirts, one blue shirt, a pink shirt, and a yellow shirt. We see them only from the back. Back to Barbara Kingsolver. Helene blew away more than houses. She exposed the bones of inadequate infrastructure. Health care and food security were already fragile here. We have almost no public transportation, so a car trapped under mud amounts to house arrest. Our hospitals are few and far between, so what happened in Irwin, Tennessee, was a grave blow. Nurses and patients at Unicoi County Hospital crowded the windows that morning to watch the Nolichucky River roar from its banks onto the surrounding fields. At 9:38, an evacuation order turned into a string of impossibilities. Within minutes, flooding engulfed the parking lot. 11 patients were taken out before the violent torrent halted water rescues. Helicopters also faced danger in turbulent winds. Slashing through water in the halls, the hospital staff rushed patients onto the roof while emergency workers weighed rescue risks against the chances of the building's collapse. Racing with time, a helicopter reached the hospital by late afternoon and lifted 54 staff members and patients to safety. 2 months later, I walked along the Nolichucky River, a river beloved in our region for its special round stones you can spot in foundations and facades of old churches, schools, and porches, including mine. 100 years ago, the man who built our farmhouse hauled river rocks from Irwin in his Model T and trained his 11 children in the art of masonry. We love our porch for its history, anchoring us to a landscape threaded with waterways. But when we pushed past its limits, the Nolichucky leveled a factory. Let me try that again, listeners. But when pushed past its limits, the Nolichucky leveled a factory and carved out mud cliffs over 20 feet above the normal water line. I crossed the silty floodplain, stepping over shards of wrecked lives, a shattered lamp decorated with fairies, a tangle of track and field championship ribbons. The sight of the hospital completed my heartache. A beautiful facility, only 6 years old, so needed by this little town, slumped in acres of mud, closed indefinitely. And listeners, just to remind us that in our last episode, we described Barbara Kingsolver in the beginning of this article as standing on her stone porch, which, again, is entirely made. Now that we've just read about this, we see that the stones were from that river, the Nolichucky there. And they are, let me take a look here, they are, in fact, Pretty rounded stones, yes, old rounded stones in the, she's leaning against a column in that porch, in that stone porch overlooking an evergreen, what appears to be a, deciduous trees, a forest. Back to our story. Every path through these hills winds between accounts of loss and survival. One of the routes was a story in itself. The Virginia Creeper Trail was repurposed from an old railroad line nicknamed the Virginia Creeper. It wasn't speedy. And that carried logs from what's now the Jefferson National Forest. Starting on Whitetop, Virginia's second highest mountain, it descends through 34 miles of Washington County woodlands and the town of Damascus, ending in Abingdon, our county seat. I can't count the hours I've spent there walking with friends, pushing strollers, and teaching two generations of our family to ride bikes. Pelline wrought havoc on half its length, washing our trail sections and destroying trestles that carry it over steep valleys. It's on Forest Service land, so the $600 million rebuild requires taxpayer support. And listeners, on this page, about a quarter of the page, there is a photo of what I'm imagining is the Nolichucky River. It's now, it seems to be dusk because there are shadows, but the sky is still a bit of a teal blue with some white, wispy white clouds in there. And the river is, the color of the water is blue here, and there are rounded stones, rounded rocks all along the river, and those rocks continue on out to the land around us. There's a dark gray shack or small house in the background, along with some green trees in the background, and some brown cliffs. And in the foreground, we see the back of a what appears to be a woman. Maybe it's Barbara Kingsolver. This is a drawing, though, of course. And she is standing on one of the round boulders, looking out at the river. Also in the foreground is a cooler and some buckets, one of them overturned. And we'll continue and finish this story in our next episode, since we've run out of time for this episode. We hope you enjoyed it, and we hope you'll listen next time. I'm Joanna LaForger, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. And remember, listeners, you need to look under Triangle Bulletin Board for those episodes. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. So long until next time.